Welcome to Innovation Calling,
the podcast where we connect the creators for the next big thing. We're your hosts, Aaron Smith
and Sia Yasotornra.
Hey, it's Aaron Smith. And before we jump into this episode, just a friendly reminder that hopefully we are going to see you in just a few more weeks for our kickoff of our Women in Tech Leadership series and our live recording of Innovation Calling. So we're going to be kicking off this series. We'll be doing this every month, but March 6th is the date that you want to be there. It's going to be at the Network Bar in Dallas, Texas, starting at 5:30. And we're going to have wine. We're going to have some appetizers. And of course, as always with Sia and myself, you know it's going to be a good time. Hopefully we are going to see you there. You can head over to innovationcalling.com to grab your tickets today. Seating is going to be extremely limited because we want to keep this intimate on purpose. So jump over to innovationcalling.com to grab those. And without further ado, here's our next episode. All right, welcome to another episode of Innovation Calling. I'm Aaron Smith.
And I'm Sia Yasotornrat. Today, we have a very special guest, as all of you have heard me over time talking about my fear of Skynet. Today, I actually found someone that's going to help correct me or frighten me with the state of robotics today. So Carl Copeland with Muse Motion, CEO and founder, welcome to the Innovation Calling.
Well, thank you guys for having me.
Very happy to have you. Carl has founded four companies. He holds more than 22 patents with dozens more pending and serves on the board of two humanitarian NGOs. It's fascinating. He focuses a particular focus on innovating pragmatic technologies that directly addresses humanity's needs and requirements. That's like a mouthful to me, and I'm thinking we're going to have to delve deep into that.
So I told Carl when he got here, I'm like, I'm going to be honest with you, Carl. I went to your website. It was like, I don't know what I just read, and I had to go watch a video of him to really explain this. So I know I'm excited to hopefully bring this up to a layman's term because it's super interesting. But I mean, it is, and you're smart, Carl. I'm sorry.
Well, I mean,
don't misinterpret information for intellect. So,
oh, stop it, you. You're very modest. So, okay, before we do anything, I have to ask you, Muse Motion, and I noticed what the actual spelling of it is not a. It's not Muse as in, a creator right. to, you know, whatever,
inspiration. Yeah.
It is an M, it's a mu, a letter Z, and then motion. Help me understand where you came that with.
Okay,
that
so name. It is a multi-layered play on words and terms. Obviously, what we're doing is a high-performance motion specifically targeting robotics. And so mu, the Greek symbol mu, which is a lot used in mathematics for micro, but in electromagnetics and motor design, the symbol mu is the placeholder for the permeability, the magnetic permeability of a given material or system. What that means is how easily will a magnetic field be conducted through a medium. So, for instance, the type of steel that's used in a motor is called electrical steel. And so it has high permeability, meaning that the magnetic fields easily flow through it. Whereas air has the lowest magnetic permeability. It resists the transmission of those magnetic fields. And so it's the, so when you're doing calculations to quantify or design a magnetic system, mu is the symbol that stands for the permeability. And because our motion system is actually leveraging the different permeabilities in order to create its effect. So that mu is a prime component to our motor design. So I'm talking to engineers who are my customer base. So the people designing and building robots, that's who we're trying to market to. And so mu is any magnetics or motor designer will, or robotics designer will understand what the mu symbol is. And then muse, because robotics is every engineer's muse. And so it's kind of a play on words. So, so we're using the Greek symbol mu, and when you either have the Greek character or you can spell it out mu when you're spelling it out, and then and so that's why I structured the name Muse Motion.
I mean, it's very unique and it's very cool, and it captured my eye when I first met with you. It was at a startup discussion and a funding meeting, if you will. So. That's what really attracted me. And then when I saw your PowerPoint presentation, I kid you not, you guys, his very first slide is literally that Terminator image. And I'm like, oh my gosh, this guy's evil. I need to understand him. He needs to be my friend. So
quite the opposite. The whole point of that reference was to alleviate people's concerns over robotics, because there's a lot of hyperbole that's out there, and it is very unfounded. So,
I was just going to say, can you back up a little bit on your journey here? Because, I mean, this is a very specific, unique field. I know it's something that's been an interest to you for a long time. Can you talk a little bit about your journey to this particular company? Because, like I said, it's extremely specific.
Yeah. So from a very young age, I was always fascinated by magnetics and by electric motors. I'm the kind of individual that it's not enough to tell me that 1 + 1 = 2. I have to literally dive in and figure out why 1 + 1 = 2. And so that's a simplified version. But, you know, just because someone said, well, you put electricity in and it makes the motor turn, that was never good enough for me, because here's an invisible force that is exerting a tremendous amount of power. I don't understand it. I don't understand how it works. I can't see anything touching, you know, so how does it do that? And so I just was always deeply fascinated by what makes a magnet a magnet. Why does it do what it does? Why does it stick to this thing and not to that thing, you know? And so, so that was an interest of mine at a very early age. I remember one of the first conversations I had on the subject was with my mother, and I was around 5 or 6 years old. And so,
her answer was just because. Yeah.
Well, actually,
I can imagine her pain right now.
Yeah. I actually get, my engineering bend from my mother. She was kind of a natural engineer in the way she approached and problem solved. Now, she was a homemaker, a mother of four, and we lived farms and ranches. So everything, you know, we ate out once a year. I mean, and it was going to Dairy Queen into town. So it was like, you know, everything we did was handmade and hand done. I think my sister made most of the dresses she ever wore, you know, her and my mother sewed them. So we lived in a very rural, very, you know, we're probably about 5 decades behind, normal, you know, city life. So, you know, in a very rural and agrarian, upbringing. And so, you know, she leveraged those skills every day. And my father, he was really the mechanical engineer. Like he was a human calculator, built jigs and rigs and all kinds of little contraptions to accomplish all of his jobs. And he was both a diesel mechanic and a welder by trade. But,
so you kind of got it from both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. But my mother was the engineer. So she actually was trying to explain to me, you know, all of the concepts. She didn't have the engineering terms and which I personally try to avoid them, unless I'm talking to other engineers, because, you know, you really have, a group of people who put Latin and nomenclature around things that are actually more simple than they appear, and because it gives them, in my opinion, it gives them a feeling of eliteness. Yeah, and so that's why doctors talk in Latin, is so that no one else understands what they're saying. And so they'll say, you know, the anterior ligament, but in Latin that means the front stretchy connector. Like, you know, yeah. I mean, yeah. It's really not as, you know, it's kind of like you hear, you hear someone say something in French or Spanish. So, oh, that's so beautiful. And he goes, he literally said he just stepped in dog crap.
Yeah.
But they thought it was so beautiful and eloquent, you know. And so it's that kind of the same thing. But so my mother, you know, she actually tried to educate me as best as she could, but it never really satisfied my curiosity. So through my entire life, I was constantly seeking knowledge and seeking more information to try to understand the natural world and the world of electromagnetism.
And then how did Muse spin off to?
Yeah. So, had a little bit different path than most people have. So I was the primary income in my household at a very young age, 11 years old, and a family of six. And when I was 13, my brother was 12. He and I were pretty much the sole income for the family, doing, you know, very menial farm work, anything that my parents could, any job they could sell us to. That's what we did. And so we were doing that in the mornings, going to school, and then coming home and doing it all night. And that's how I fed my siblings. So when I was 19, I ended that situation, evicted my parents and moved on. So that, you know, it was a completely different path. You know, I get that. And so, sheer will and determination in the long, painful road to, you know, as far as, of dealing with the need for education information. But I built a career in marketing and advertising, and then moved into the interactive space right as it was coming on board, and pioneered, in those areas. And then, because I have a natural knack for technology and technical architecture and all of those things. And so, whether it's electronic or data or mechanical, it's just kind of a natural bend for me. So, continued, educating throughout, trying to do the home and family and child rearing and all that, continued to self-educate and seek other forms of education. And then, but I had the concept for these magnetics over 25 years ago. And so I was the garage tinkerer, right? So I'm tinkering around, playing around, trying to prove it out, because it's a completely novel and radical shift in magnetics. And so two of the members of my team, one of them, his name is Dan Jones, and he's a legend in the electric motor world. He's the keynote speaker at pretty much every motor and drive conference in the Western world. Two of the programs that he was directly involved in, just two of them, not all of them, but one of them, he designed and built all the motors for the moon buggies, as well as the motors for the Viking, the first Mars rover, the Viking program. So this guy's a legend. And so when he saw my motion system for the first time, he was like, okay, this is the first time in my entire career that I've seen something that was actually novel.
So can we take a step back here then, just because you're talking, okay.
Yeah, so, I jumped ahead.
No, that's fine. That's fine. And for someone like me, don't worry about it. I was lost about it. I understood that you raised you had to support your family. I got that part very well. So your solution, your business is based on product. I don't want to call your pieces products, but it's magnetic based.
A magnetic platform. Yeah, all motors are magnetic.
Okay.
So matter of fact, we call it all now electromagnetism, because electricity and magnetism are the same exact force. It's actually the same force that bonds atoms together to make molecules. It bonds the subatomic together to make the atoms. And so it's an electromagnetic force that you couple things together. And so, and the way motors work is they have one magnetic field that pushes or pulls against another magnetic field. And that creates the type of motion, whether it's linear, rotational, whatever type of motion you're trying to create. That's how an electric motor works. And so it's all based on magnetics.
That's crazy. That's so cool. I mean, I knew it intuitively, obviously, but you're actually making me do the visual and think about it for once.
Right.
Which is frightening. You shouldn't make me think about things. I'm just telling you. So let's talk about this, Carl. I think I'm fascinated by your background, and you've been in it obviously since wee little kid. So tell me about the state of robotics, because I see all sorts of stuff. I've talked and I've made fun of Boston Dynamics. One day they may eventually get on our podcast and yell at me greatly. But yeah. I mean, I also recently saw and I posted a video on the Acrobats at Disney. Yes. Imagineering put together, which blew my mind and freaked me out. And I was itching to want to talk to you and call you in advance, but I figured I should wait for our discussion here. So talk to me about the state of robotics, because you run the full gamut of it's good for us.
Yes.
And then there is, again, for me, because I'm raised in Hollywood, the Terminator side of things.
Yes. Which again, like I said, is a lot of hyperbole taken to the extreme. So where we're at with robotics is we've actually had the control systems, the engineering capabilities, and the artificial intelligence side of engineering in order to produce that George Jetson, AI level robot. You know, the movie I, Robot. We've had the engineering to get close to there for a very long time. The number one problem in robotics is the type of motion system that you use to power it. In other words, the motors. So when you look at Boston Dynamics and you look at their Atlas platform, which is the one that you see doing parkour in the videos. So if you go back just to 2015, that thing could barely stand up on its own. It could barely walk over a pile of concrete. And, you know, I think they placed second place in a DARPA challenge for a search and rescue robot. And they would have won first if they hadn't had a fall that damaged one of the systems. So they lost by just mere seconds to the South Korean team. But that was how, I mean, when you look at most of the robots that were in that competition, there's a fail video that's very popular on YouTube. It's hilarious where these robots are jittering and shuddering and falling over. And people think that that's because the controls and the software, which don't get me wrong, the fixes for that were primarily controls and software, but not because the controls and software were lacking. It was because they're dealing with horribly inefficient and inaccurate motion systems. And the reason for that is that the motors that literally power these robots, in order to do something where they can lift any reasonable amount of weight, the only place they can go for that kind of torque is a hydraulic motor. So those robots, the dancing dog robot you see, the Atlas robot you see, those are hydraulic systems. They're not electromagnetic motors or electric motors powering those. What they have is they have a battery that runs an electric motor that powers a hydraulic pump. And that hydraulic pump creates, you know, hydraulic pressure, and it can be, you know, 3 to 6,000 PSI systems. And then they have specialized little electric controllers, actuators that change the flow and direction of the hydraulics in order to mimic that motion. So they're doing some very, very complicated systems in order to get a hydraulic system to replicate natural motion. And there are electric motors that can perform at those performances, and they're called servo motors. And a servo motor is a very, very high performance motor. But the problem with them is they're insanely weak and significantly heavy for what they do. So the way I like to explain to people what the different types of electric motors are is you have on one end, you have the big industrial motors. Think of them like the bull elephant. We call those traction motors. They're also referred to as brushless DC motors, although there's AC versions out there. And that's what now you see, you have either an AC or DC traction motor. Now, these are the motors that move locomotives down the rail. Okay. Now, most people don't realize that a locomotive has been a hybrid vehicle since the 40s.
What do you mean by hybrid?
So it's a diesel engine that runs, that powers a generator. That generator produces electricity that powers the traction motors that are on each axle of that locomotive. If it were not for that system, those trains could maybe pull a tenth of what they're pulling now.
Oh.
I mean, yeah. So a combustion engine is a very low torque inefficient engine. Yeah. Diesels are on the other end where they are high torque, lower RPM, but they have to reach a certain RPM before they can deliver their torque. That's why when you see these funny cars and drag racers and they rev their engines to near explosion points and then they pop the clutch and take off. Yeah. The reason is all of the torque in that motor is at the high end of the RPMs. What differs about an electric system is an electric motor has maximum torque at zero RPM. So it delivers. So if you have a motor, like I have a truck and it has 947 foot-pounds of torque, let's say 950. So that 950 foot-pounds of torque, I only get at 3,000 to 4,000 RPM in the motor. Whereas if I had a 950 foot-pound torque electric motor, I get that at zero RPM. I get that from the moment I touch the pedal. So now they will not even allow. There was one guy who built a car called the White Zombie, and it was an old Datsun that he converted to an all electric. And he so thoroughly smoked every other car that the very next year they banned electrics from the combustion engine drag circuit and created its own electric drag circuit, because that's how more powerful an electric motor is. So that's why they do locomotives the way they do it, is because they need to convert they need maximum torque at zero RPM to pull those loads. And to give you the insanity of the efficiency of these systems, I saw a billboard that GE put up 10 years ago or more. And the claim on the billboard was that their locomotive could pull 100,000 tons of cargo 10 miles on less than a penny.
Wow.
So that's why all these hybrid vehicles on the roads are such a joke. I mean, they're really a joke. Matter of fact, if you were serious about doing a hybrid, you would have a small high torque diesel that was running an electric generator that was powering electric motors on each wheel. And that's the ultimate hybrid, because you're getting the maximum conversion of liquid energy, which is the fuel, to, you know, to energy applied at the drivetrain. So maybe
that's another future podcast where you find someone that's got automotive background. But is that we don't use diesel in the United States as much as the rest of the world, right?
No, so and I will say
it's not sexy to say, hey, you've got a hybrid diesel.
That's why they do it. Is that the primary infrastructure in the U.S. is gasoline. And that's what everyone's familiar and comfortable with. And there's fueling stations around every corner, and it's a little more difficult to find diesel. And what's even worse is now, so I have a diesel truck, as I mentioned before. And so for me, there's a fluid called diesel exhaust fluid, or DEF. And now you have to fill up with that as well as diesel, because it injects a chemical to help mitigate pollution coming out of the diesel. You see the black smoke coming out of the older diesels. Well, this fluid eliminates that black smoke. But now I have to go to a truck, like a full on truck stop, to be able to find that fluid. And it's a real pain to go and get that fluid, you know, every 6 months. But if you're going to get it from a gas station. So diesel, the infrastructure is not here, but you know, the one of the issues with diesel too is unless it's a well-designed system, it does pollute more. Like that was what happened with Volkswagen and the lawsuit. And now there's another company, you know, under a similar lawsuit where they were detecting whether the car was being emissions tested or not, and they would change the electronics to make the engine run more efficient. And then when it was on the street, they just ran it for more power, and they didn't care about the emissions. So they were kind of cheating the system, and they, you know, Volkswagen got hit really hard on that. But they were doing that because of the pollution of a diesel. And so there's some reasons why. There's both kind of the marketing and political reasons why they're doing gas, as well as, you know, some other, and the infrastructure is another issue. But really, if you're looking for a truly efficient, you would actually reduce the pollution doing a diesel hybrid, because you would reduce the fuel consumed, because you get a much more efficient system.
So, because here's what intriguing me, is you had this idea 25 years ago.
Yes.
You've been working on this for 25 years. And it seems to me that with technology moving in the way it has, and as many advancements as there's been, that there's nobody's taken, you know what I mean? That there's still an opportunity for something you've been working on 25 years.
So I'll back up and finish that statement that I rabbit trailed from. So you have the big powerful motors that I typify them as bull elephants. That's the traction motors in the locomotives.
Right.
Same thing, you'd want to put them in vehicles or any heavy industrial application. So, and you have a scale of them. You have some of them that are like, you know, a plow horse, and some of them that are like the elephant, you know, so you have different scales, but those are the heavy end. Then you have the high performance motors that are on the other end. So there's a type of motor called a stepper motor. And where you'd be familiar with that one is it's pretty much what runs inkjet printers. It runs CNC machines. You know, any kind of CNC automation they use to move the gantries around, they use what are called stepper motors, because they have enough torque to hold position, but they step so you can accurately position it where you want it in an XY configuration, you know, or Z, depending on how many motors you put in there. So the stepper motors are primarily what's used in any kind of CNC milling, 3D printing application. And then the highest end of performance, I would consider those stepper motors, think of them like a Greyhound. Or, you know, something like that. So it has a lot of performance, but it still has a little bit of, you know, like sled dogs, for instance. They're able to pull a sled, but they're also pretty quick and agile. Then you have on the very high end, you have servo motors, and those are the hummingbirds of the motor world. So they have massive amounts of performance. I mean, their wing beats, their speed of adjusting and hovering and all that, but they have no lift capacity whatsoever, right? So you're always in a motor, you're always trading torque, which is force. You're trading that for speed. And it's not just RPM, it's literally the ability to move from one point to the next. How quickly can you do that? Especially in robotics, you need to be able to go back and forth very, very rapidly, like your muscles interact.
Right.
And so that's the spectrum of robotics. So our motion systems are all, you know, running on electricity because these robots are going to be powered, whether it's through, you know, batteries or, you know, hydrogen fuel cells or supercapacitors or whatever the power source is. It's just taking electrical power and converting that to mechanical power. So, because that's all motors are, torque converters. They convert, you know, one form of torque, mechanical, into electrical. That's a generator, or electrical into mechanical. And that's what we call a motor, even though they're, in engineering terms, they're all motors.
Yeah.
So in robotics, what you really want, what we need in robotics, and what's holding up the George Jetson, you know, AI level robotics, is the motion systems themselves. Because we have the artificial intelligence to perform most tasks. Matter of fact, if you look at the current state of what are called cobots, which are cobot is short for collaborative robotics. So these are robots that are able to safely interact and augment human activity, interact with humans and augment their daily tasks. So they're specifically designed to work in the working environment alongside humans, in direct contact with humans. So if you look at an automotive plant where you got those giant robots that are building cars, those things have, you know, 20-foot safety barriers around them. You have to do two levels, three levels of lockout to go in and service them, because they're very, again, those are hydraulic and they're very dangerous, because they don't know you're there. They don't care that you're there. They'll go through you or over you. They don't care.
And those are cobots?
Those are standard industrial robots.
Okay. What makes them the dead, unseeing. It's just they're coded to move left to right 30 degrees and put it down.
Okay. They're programmed to pick, you know, to do the heavy industrial manufacturing and so forth. A cobot, what differs a cobot is that it uses servo motors, those high performance motors I was telling you about. So the beautiful thing about a servo is not only is it an output device, it's also an input device. They're very sophisticated. So they're like a giant sensor bank. So by moving the motor, it sends signals back to the controls, the electronic controls, and tells the computer where that motor is, thus where the robot is. And so it's a two-way communication path. And so what makes cobots unique is if they come into contact with an unexpected obstruction, whether that's a human or a product or whatever, it will immediately sense that change, that unexpected change in torque, and shut the system down and go into a standby mode, preventing damage or injury. And so
what you're describing is, because I saw you posted an article on LinkedIn where there was a robot drywalling.
Yes.
And picking up. So what you're saying is that would be an example of a cobot.
Well, that robot will have to be a cobot in order to safely interact with humans. The one you saw right there was a hydraulic-based robot. It's the Atlas platform. That was a DARPA-funded initiative, and that's what Boston Dynamics received the final grant of that IP, and that's what their parkour robot is based on. It's the Atlas. It's the most advanced level of that Atlas platform, and so that is currently not a cobot. It is they have to put safety barriers. You can't be around it. It's hydraulic. But in order for it to interact with humans, it would have to have that cobot function. And it doesn't have it right now because servos are hummingbirds. They have no lift capacity. In fact, they're trading all of their torque and lifting capacity for that high, super high performance speed of being able to start and stop. And rapidly. And so because of that, they can't even lift their own weight hardly. Matter of fact, that's why you won't see a servo in a robot taller than, you know, 12 inches, because it can't support its own weight when you scale it any bigger than that. And that's where our motion system kind of differs. What I've been working on the last, you know, 9 years, really we've only been working on his motion system for about the last 14 to 18 months. But where we differ is that we're able to deliver the superior high performances of a servo, but we can do it with the torque of these bull elephant traction motors.
Oh, that's sexy.
Yeah. And that's kind of the holy grail of robotics is we're seeing, you know, 10 times the torque or better, but we're also 30 times quicker. So our hummingbird is 30 times faster than anyone else's hummingbird of the same class.
Wow.
But we have the strength of the plow ox and bull elephant So that now the robot can function with power. Because right now, the cobots you see on the market, and probably the most successful cobot company internationally, is Universal Robotics. And they have a really elegant solution. In fact, sadly, one of the customers we were targeting up until a few months ago was Rethink Robotics, that was out of Boston. And they were the U.S. company that was the direct competition for Universal. But the problem with them is they're Cobot had a 6-pound load limit. And that was, by the way, that was up close to the mainframe. If the arm was fully extended, it might have been 2 pounds. So very, very light. Yeah. No. And Universal, they understood the challenges in the motion market. So they actually stood up their own motor company because unfortunately, Dan Jones, Newman, I referenced before, one of his favorite statements is that motor companies are dinosaurs thoroughly set in concrete. They've got the infrastructure and tooling in place. They're not going to update, modify, tool up for new stuff. They like their markets and margins are so thin that they're not really looking to innovate. They're just looking to keep their market share or grow their market share in the traditional market. So they won't innovate for these low volume robotics applications because they're after the real high volume, traditional motors. And so Universal stood up their own motor company to produce their own motor. So they have a 10 kilogram or 22 pound capacity on their high-end cobot. So when you're looking at 6 to 8 pounds versus 22 pounds, who's going to win? Well, I can do more in my shop with a 22 pound cobot. And so even though you need all the cobot performances, you still have to pick stuff up.
You still have to do things.
Sadly, because of that disparity, that's primarily what caused Rethink to close their doors back in September, October.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. It is unfortunate. Yeah.
So I guess I'm getting a little confused then. So
yeah, I've been around a bit here. So
yeah,
sorry.
No, and I ongoing theme, I'm always confused. But beside that, so help me understand your market then, where you fit. And what would be a typical customer that would want to leverage your motors and your solution? Because I'm getting confused now.
So I explained a little bit about some of the issues with the cobots is the really limited load capacity.
Right.
So in order to get those super high performances so the beautiful thing about a cobot is you can actually grab the robot arm and move it and manipulate. So let's take your most skilled worker and they have a specific task that they're doing. You can hook the tools that they need to the cobot and the worker can grab that cobot arm and do their job with the cobot. And it's recording everything, the forces, the motions. It's looking at the part and understanding with the 3D imaging what part of the item that you're working on it needs to focus on. So if there's changes in position, it doesn't affect its performance. And so, you know, it takes about 2 weeks of that kind of interaction, and you now have replicated your best employee into that cobot. But again, they're limited in their load capacity, what size tools, what they can pick up, all those things. So where we come in is we can provide all of those cobot performances, but instead of being limited to 22 pounds or 10 pounds or whatever the cobot's limited to, imagine a cobot with those performances, but it can lift 200, 300, 500 pounds. That's what our motion system will be delivering to the robotics market. So now instead of a robot, it can barely, like you saw the Atlas robot that was doing parkour. Well, that was really the limit of its ability. It was managing its own weight to do all of that, but it couldn't do that with much more added to it. And it probably took them 10, 15 runs to get it perfect on that video.
Yeah. So I was just going to ask, the ROI really isn't quite there if it takes that much development.
It's not
that
dependable.
Exactly.
For that little bit of benefit.
So where we would change it is, first of all, we would be doing electric motors. So you don't have all the hydraulic pumps and fluid and lines that have weight and complexity and fail points. Because a hydraulic system is a single point failure system. Yeah. You have a leak in a line or a bad pump, the whole thing's done. We'll get to that on my motion system, I guess, in a minute. I got off track there for a little bit. Let me regroup. So we have the limits of the weight and all of that, but you also have the fact that it's really at the end of its performance level. But imagine a robot that would be able to do that with an electrical system without all the mess and weight of the hydraulic, with the reliability of an electrical system, but it'd be able to carry two more robots on its back while it did it. So that's what we're talking. We're talking about a robot with the think of a humanoid robot with the performance of an Olympic athlete.
Yeah. So basically, you are basically confirming my greatest fear is you are the foundation now as we switch over a more efficient technology to create these killer robots.
Well, okay. So the killer side is us anthropomorphizing the human condition into a machine that does not have our failings. So there's not a single computer on the planet that is not data in, data out. And so when we're talking about AI, what we're really talking about is a sophisticated conglomeration of algorithms that are able to execute more and more sophisticated operations based on what we tell it to do. But it is not creatively thinking. It is not dynamically problem solving. It is simply repeating what we've become more and more creative in how we build these algorithms and how we build these software systems in order to emulate human small windows of human behavior. But they are not, my personal opinion is this whole concept of singularity is one of the biggest farces that has people stoked up. It's just really not possible. I mean, if you understand the physiology of the human and the human neural network, first of all, we're learning now that that your cranium is not the majority of your brain. You actually have more neurons and neural pathways in your gut than you do in your head. And they're actually learning that those centers are a significant source of data processing and intelligence. And so you actually have three tiny little brains on your heart. You know, I mean, so our neural system is more diverse than you know, we're learning that and it's being confirmed more and more how diverse it is. But when you creatively problem solve, that actually happens in your subconscious. No matter how, that's why when you try to force yourself to solve a problem, you hit that wall of frustration. And then you have that aha moment in the shower. And you're like, oh, okay. Well, that's because your subconscious, it runs at 20,000 cycles a second faster than your conscious mind.
Oh my God.
And so if you can quantify the problem, and I utilize this all the time. So you quantify to the best of your ability, you get all the information you can get, and you look at the problem, and then what I do is I walk away and I go do something else, something that doesn't require a massive amount of thought. And I let my subconscious work on it, and then in due course, it'll eventually present me with a series of, here's some possible solutions, I try them out, find out what didn't work, and now I've got another set of data to enhance, you know, that first set of presumptions. And so that's how your brain, when it's doing that, it is taking all of your knowledge and experiences, and it is, and even your new ones and your old ones, and it's interconnected, it's building brand new neural pathways between those data points. Find me a computer that can organically do that. I mean, we'll eventually probably get to some form of organic processor and data storage, but it is not going to be, I mean, you're never going to match the human creative potential. We're not going to have robot overlords. We will be the robot overlords.
You're so quashing everything that I've functioned on.
Yeah. If a robot does something sinister, you need to go directly to the programmer or programmers because they're the one, because it was just simply doing what they told it to do. They don't make irrational choices like we do. They follow set algorithms.
It's probably better sometimes, although your gut is a good indicator. But
yes.
What are some of your biggest challenges? Like you're building something new, in a different way. What are some of your biggest challenges as you're building this company right now?
Well, so, we've got a very disruptive technology. And it's a very high tech field. Our customers are high tech, let alone our solution for our customers. And so I'd say the number one challenge is the burden to educate, potential partners and investors, and on what we're doing, to the point where we're not overwhelming them with information, but we're giving them enough to get excited about partnering with us.
If I'm an engineer, am I like, this is amazing, I'm on board. Get me more of this. Okay.
Yeah. If you're an engineer, especially if you're a robotics developer, any experience in motion, like the guys I show our system to are very, very excited because I hadn't even touched on some of the key points of it, which is not only do we have this new really high torque, high speed magnetics, but they're fragmented, meaning they're broken up into small little groups. And as a result, we can actually build a motor with 15% the magnetic components, meaning steel, magnets, and copper wire. We can build it with 15% of that as compared to a same class servo. So to get the same performance, if we're matching the size of the motors, only 15% of our motor has to be the steel, copper, and magnets. And therefore, we can build the rest of the motor out of very lightweight composite materials, injection mold them, 3D print them, all forms of additive and manufacturing, and meaning that our motor, when you measure, because of our torque density, when you measure the torque of our motor to the torque of the competitive motor, we're 5% the weight for every unit of torque or Newton meter of torque.
So if I'm looking to go into this business, or I'm going to manufacture some kind of robot or something, you're very sexy. I mean, you are basically being more efficient, more performance, so lighter, cheaper, with
faster, stronger.
Okay, so why aren't you like a bajillionaire by now? So help me understand your challenges from a business perspective. This is a startup, right? So
It is.
So from a business outside of a burden to educate, though, I mean, what else is there a challenge going on as far as, you know, is it?
So it's, you know, I will tell you that I'm sad to report that Texas is a very, very poor environment to try to raise high tech startup capital. Everyone wants the super simple, safe and easy, investments. And I would like to say that I'm sure we have smart money here, but it's not being implemented here. I mean, the majority, 70 to 80% of the investment dollars in Texas are going out of state because they want simple things, real estate, oil and gas, cell phone apps. They're not investing in high tech things. Right. And they don't want to wait, you know, two to five years for the returns to start. And they just want simple. And real estate here is so easy and oil and gas is so easy that why venture? And so almost all of their investments are going outside of Texas. And most of the entrepreneurs and startups in Texas, 70 to 80% of the capital they're raising is being raised out of state. It's either Silicon Valley or the East Coast or West Coast is where you're having to go, which is sad. And I've been trying really hard to try to, again, there's the high level of technical acumen in what we're doing. And so that's a difficulty in having those conversations. And then there's just not a lot of people with the appetite for a really high tech startup. And so we're now having to, and I was trying to keep it here in local. That's what I wanted to do, but we're now having to look at going out of state for that capital. And so those are the two biggest challenges really is the acquiring a startup capital for something so technical. And plus so there's things that people don't understand about the motor market either is this isn't something that I can just go license to another motor company to produce. That's not how the motor market works. Again, they're dinosaurs set in concrete, right? So, they don't want the innovation. They don't want the retooling and innovation. They just don't want you to compete with them. And so what we're forced to do is not only we have the R&D and the development side of our magnetics, but we're having to implement our own manufacturing as well. So we're having to become a full motor company in order to produce these. Now, I will say that our rapid prototyping and production system that I've designed is probably going to be in the long term more disruptive than our motion system. Because of the material diversity of our platform, meaning that the majority, 80% of our motor can be injection molded, CNC machined, 3D printed. That means that I have a world of brand new manufacturing technologies available. Plus we're automating 80% of it. And so we're going to be able, so for instance, if someone orders a custom motor now from a motor company, it could take them 6 months to a year to get that motor. Whereas we're going to be able, once that system's up and running, we'll be able to produce those prototypes in 5 business days.
So you're like selling all the great value points about Muse Motion, what you guys can do. And I'm not picking on Texas, but I understand what you're saying because I've seen it as well. I think that's a great opportunity for those that are listening that have investment dollars here in Texas. I think there's so many great organizations and companies that we've been talking to. I mean, it makes sense that could there potentially be a partnership or collaboration that you'd be interested in with another major corporation that maybe they want you guys, like, they want to incubate you internally within them?
Oh, absolutely.
Is that something you'd be interested in as well? Or are you looking for more just independent dollars?
Well, it would have to be a robotics company that would be interested in incubating.
Well, not necessarily, okay. No, because we have – so we're focusing right now on the high-performance robotics, automata or humanoid, and the cobot market, because those are the markets that would benefit the most. But we actually – when you think about the aerospace and aeronautic applications of this, so you have something that's 5% the weight for the same amount of torque with 30 times the speed – thinking of it as a servo. So when it costs you $10,000 a pound to launch something into orbit, and we can come in with a motor that's 5% the weight for the same performance. So there's huge aerospace and aeronautics, but there's large regulatory burdens in that. Anything that's going to move a human being or move a multi-million dollar payload, there's a lot of regulatory stuff and a lot of testing and all that has to go into it. Whereas in the automotive field, which is all R&D, we don't have any of that. We can rapidly integrate and iterate. And same thing with cobots. There's not a regulatory burden to them. And so we can rapidly enter that market. But we definitely are looking to partner with anyone who wants to move something, because we also have versions of this motor on design that are not servos. They're more of the standard DC motors. So we get all of the weight benefits to a traditional, standard motor. And it's actually a simpler configuration in the magnetics. And so, so there's a multitude of applications that we'll be delving into.
I mean, I'm just thinking about, obviously, the military applications, right? I mean, to me, it's a no-brainer. But, I just popped in my head, and I don't know anything about it. I'm just thinking out loud, is Amazon, with them wanting to do the drones and delivery, I still don't understand how they were expecting to deliver stuff more than a certain amount of weight. I'm imagining what you guys are saying is, look, within your own
motor,
you can carry a heavier product across safer.
Yeah, we transfer.
Integrate it, right? I mean,
we take away from the airframe's weight, and we make that weight available for additional payload. So for 5% the weight, then that's 95% of the motor weight that's now available for payload. And of course, some of the drones that are out now are significantly large and can lift heavy payloads. I think the energy storage, as far as, batteries and supercapacitors and so forth, that's the range limiting factor for electrics right now. But if you look at the Blackfly, that's the new, multi-rotor transport, that thing has a 200-mile range. So you turn that from a human payload to an Amazon payload, and you just have to look at the cost of the operating that airframe. But those are the lift capacities of drones are there. It's the range, and that's where 5% the weight, again, it gives you the extra payload and enhances your range and so forth. But those would actually be more of the simplified brushless motor. Yeah, the AC traction motors that we would produce. They would be, because they're just looking for raw thrust. They're not needing the servo level of performance.
Sure.
And so, but again, we have both. We have the servos. We have 9 prototypes on the bench on those. And I would say, back to one of your questions about what's limiting is we are still finalizing, because our magnetics are very, very unique. I mean, we really have 6 3-phase motors within a common motor housing. And so that has to all be coordinated and controlled. And the magnetics are very, very unique. Matter of fact, there's not a simulator out there that can accurately simulate our magnetics, because it's that much of a divergence from traditional motor magnetics. And so as a result, our controls are, that's really the soft, we're on the final stages of, we've got the hardware developed. We're just in the final stages of trying to finish the software. But of course, my difficulty in raising the capital has slowed that pace down, sadly. So
on that note, how can we get a hold of you, Carl? Because I actually want to keep talking to you, but we all have a time limit here, and I want to be respectful. So if I could, can you come back and can we continue some more conversations?
We'd love to. Absolutely.
Because you are so amazing and you have so much to say, but If we want to get a hold of Carl Copeland at Muse Motion, how can we do that, sir?
Well, you can go to our website, musemotion.com. And our email
make
is...
Make sure you spell that, too.
Sorry, yeah. Muse, M-U-Z, Motion, M-O-T-I-O-N, if I can spell, .com. And then the same thing, you can email us at lab, L-A-B, at musemotion.com. And our phone number is also on the screen as well, or on that website as well. And feel free to call my personal cell phone, 817-770-2611.
Excellent. Carl, you are such an amazing person. I wish you the best of luck. And obviously, if we can make connections for you and get you, the partnership or the VC, et cetera, I'd be thrilled. Just remember Aaron and me. Kindly remember us.
Can do.
And
when Aaron, you become the, what did you say, bajillionaire?
Bajillionaire.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. Do you have anything to say? Or?
No, I just want to thank you for coming in. This has been, I was worried. I'll be honest. Last night, I'm like, I don't know if I would have filed, but it makes a lot of sense. It's very intriguing what you're doing, and I really appreciate you taking the time to break it down for us today.
Well, yeah, and I appreciate you guys having me, and I know I've got a pile of left hanging questions for you. So we just kind of scratched some of the surface, but looking forward to coming back around again.
Excellent. Thank you very much. And that's wrap up for another episode of Innovation Calling.